If you'd like to open to 1 Samuel 17, and remember 1 Samuel 17, it's where the David and Goliath story is. Everybody knows the story of David and Goliath. Nobody knows how to find it. Okay, I'm going to bring this forward. It's really not a key thing in today's message, even though today is the story of David and Goliath. This is a reasonably authentic facsimile of Goliath's spear, with the exception that Goliath would never put a nail in the end of his spear to hang. I just picture throwing it and having that nail rip your hand right here. Every time I cringe, it's like, the spear's going to kill somebody. I should cringe at that. It's not. It's the nail that gets me. So this is, by the way, thank you, Richard McCollum. This is a reasonable facsimile of David's sling. I went out and practiced with it a while. I learned that if I had been in David's shoes, Goliath would still be standing. Except he might have fallen down laughing and been so incapacitated I could have done something. But basically, I have this kind of tied in here. See if I can even do it. I watched a couple of YouTubes on it so that I was an expert, and then I went out and tried it so that I was a goof. But, you know, basically it's something like that. And it would help if I had a good shoulder. He says basically, one of them basically said, make a throwing motion. I go, well, I can't make a throwing motion. Can I do underhand? But this is a reasonable facsimile of what David's sling was. And this is, we don't know what Goliath's spear looked like. We know that the head of his spear was 15 pounds. This one is only, thank you, Tim Shifley, for the spearhead, only 7.5 pounds, which makes it just slightly under the weight of my sledgehammer, which gives, I think, a really good perspective to do with it. Goliath's spearhead was twice that. I think it's probably to scale about right, because it would have been bulkier. And I have, I'll bring them up later. Some spearheads they've actually dug up. I'm going to show some pictures. The thing is this spearhead, by the way, or this spear, the shaft, like a weaver's, whatever, yeah. Thank you. I was losing the word. This is actually slightly smaller. Should be about a quarter of an inch thicker, to be completely right. It is 9 foot, 9 1/4 inches long, top to bottom. Goliath was 6 cubits and a span, which makes him about 9'9", and which means he's that tall. And so trying to figure out what should a spear, because I did the shaft, Tim did the spearhead, and the problem is trying to figure out how tall do you make it. And so I made it his height. And I think that's really helpful, because one of the things you see about this is that, put in perspective, instead of having someone, picture me first, 4 foot taller, and I'd be about there, right? So picture me 4 foot taller and with this spear. One of the things you notice about it is all of a sudden, instead of being this massive spearhead the size of a sledgehammer, it's proportional and it doesn't look bad. It actually looks like it would be maybe right. And you go, huh, that's interesting. Some of the things come together. But this is just nothing but props. By the way, Josh did tell me last week, my son Josh, who we did the pulpit exchange last week, he loved it here last week. But he did tell me that he had planned to come in and tell you all that he was cooler than me, but then he saw the Goliath spear sitting here, and he had to give me something for that, which I'm really glad I have props, because I have to cheat. But I don't mind. You can go to tell everybody. My pastor cheats. So, okay. That's just kind of some introductory stuff before we start in the story of David and Goliath. It's easily one of the best known stories of the Bible. It is so well known and so popular that it has been relegated to a children's story. And very few Christian adults spend much time with the story of David and Goliath. We treat it that way, almost like a fairy tale. It has a good moral lesson. It's a good story to learn about courage and faith. But very few Christian adults have the willingness to treat it as if it's real. And I want to say that there's a disconnect in that kind of thinking. I am going to treat this as real because I believe it is real. And we'll look at some evidence, by the way. This story, by the way, is way too much for one sermon if I was doing it right, but I'm going to do it in one anyway, so I'm going to limit it to these three points. We're going to consider Goliath, meaning the reality of this monstrous man, that the Israelite, consider Goliath, then that the Israelites were defeated without a battle when they met Goliath, and then we find that David, with simple faith, got the victory. So first, Goliath, the Philistine. Let's look at this, verses chapter 17, verses 1 through 3. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and camped in the Valley of Elah and drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. So you have this, the battle lines are drawn. So the Philistines live in these, mostly in these five cities and the area surrounding them, in what today we know pretty much as the Gaza Strip. I'm not going to say the borders were exactly the same, but essentially that's the area where the Philistines lived. They had five Philistine cities and five kings. These were kings. Each city was a city-state. Gaza, Ashkelon, Ashdod, Ekron, and Gath. And Gath is the one we know because of Goliath of Gath. And they're in that area. And in fact, it's believed that our word Palestine comes from the word Philistine. And it's just transposed over the years. And so we have Palestine. And if you are in those cities and you want to invade into Israel, the natural route for you to take would be this Elah Valley. It starts wide and flat. It narrows a little bit as you go on, but it stays flat as you go in. And by the time you get to Ephes-Damim between Soko and Azekah, it's kind of narrowing and becomes a little bit of a bottleneck. And so here you see, I hope this shows up well. We lose a little bit when we go to the projector. It looks better on my computer. Here you see, here's where Gath is. You have this flat area that comes along here. You have the other cities of the Philistines. Gath is pretty much the one closest to the hills, hill country. The others are a little bit farther back. They come over here. They hit the mouth of the Valley of Elah, and they come up this long, flat valley. And you can see, looking at that, how flat it is. And you have the hills on either side. You have the flat valley in between. And here we have where they show the Israelite camp. Here they show the Philistine camp. I might even be looking at that backwards. Here's another view of the same thing from an airplane. And so you see again, you have the valley. You can see it laid out like this. And you can just get that sense of how flat it is. In fact, this would, if the Philistines have chariots and things like this, you go, wow, yeah, we're taking this. We're not going through here. You could hike over those mountains without a whole lot of trouble. But you can just kind of see it. So what happens is the Philistines get one side, the Israelites get the other, and they stop. And you could go by. It's the easiest way to go. But the Israelites, by taking that, because I had always visioned when I first read the story that one army lined up across this way and the other army lined up across this way and blocked the valley, and they just headed off, and so the Philistines couldn't get by because they'd have to do this head-to-head thing and the Israelites would stop them. But it's not like that. It's more like the Israelites are here, the Philistines are here, and if the Philistines come down to move, then the Israelites have their flank, can take them from the flank, which is a harder to protect area. Either way, the Philistines get there, they pull up camp and stop, and the Israelites come here, and that's where they go. Okay, so we're going to leave those for a few minutes. You kind of have that picture. So the Philistine strategy is really interesting when you look at it. For an invading army, their assault is very passive. Because usually if you invade an army, you expect to do battle. And so when the other army comes out, you say, okay, now we're going to have the battle. But they don't have the battle. They sit off not having this battle. I think they remember the last time they invaded Israel. If we go back a few pages, because there's a lot of history here that's actually happening over a short amount of time. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, verses 5 through 7, this is Jonathan's battle. So also, 1 Samuel chapter 13, starting at verse 7, some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead, but as for Saul, by the way, that means they're running away. The Philistines have invaded Israel. Saul gathers the people at Gilgal. The Israelites see the number and the size of the Philistine army, and some of them say, I'm out of here, and they cross the river getting away. It's like fleeing to Canada or fleeing to Mexico or something. They're getting out of Dodge because there's going to be a war in Dodge. They say, we can't win this war, and so they start running. Okay, Saul stays in Gilgal. Let me find my passage I want again. I'm sorry. Now the Philistines assembled to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots and 6,000 horsemen and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. And they came up and camped at Michmash east of Beth-Aven. When the men of Israel saw that they were in a strait, for the people were hard pressed, then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. And some of the Hebrews crossed the Jordan into the land of Gad and Gilead. But as for Saul, he was still at Gilgal, and all the people followed him trembling. So I read the last verse first. Sorry about that. But you get this picture is everybody's running. They're hiding. They're finding places to hide out. They're saying, I don't know. We can't fight this war. There's too many of them. There's too few of us. We're going to hide. Okay, we go on a little bit farther. Skip down to verses 19 to 22. That's not only the size of the Israelite army at this point. Let's look at what kind of shape they were in militarily. Now, no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make spears, swords, or spears. So all Israel went down to the Philistines, each to sharpen his plowshare, his mattocks, his axe, and his hoe. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshare, the mattocks, and the forks, and the axes, and to fix the hoes. So it came about on the day of battle that neither sword nor spear was found in the hands of any of the people who were with Saul and Jonathan, but they were found with Saul and his son Jonathan. So you have an army well-armed and armored and great in number, and you have an army small and disorganized and poorly outfitted, right? Those are the two armies. Israel has no business being in this battle. Israel at this point ought to say, you know what? Let's find out how we can make peace. But then we go to 1 Samuel 14, verse 6. It says, then Jonathan is Saul's son. Jonathan is awesome. Jessica, if he thinks I'm talking about him, just smack him. So, Jessica. We have two Jonathan and Jessicas here. You know, it's just really hard on my brain. So, so that goes for both of you. But I'm sorry, that one looks more like Goliath. Anyway. Now I have to get my brain back. Oh, 14:6. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, come and let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised Philistines. Perhaps the Lord will work up for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few. So he's not just spouting words. I think these were words that were popular in Israel. The Lord is able to save by many or by few. A lot of people are really good with words when it doesn't come time to actually act on those words. Jonathan, he's going to act on those words. He says, yeah, you know all those Philistines up there? Let's you and I go attack them. Because God can save by many or by few, and he means it. So we go down to verses 8 through 15. Then Jonathan said, behold, we will cross over to the men and reveal ourselves to them. If they say to us, wait until we come up to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has given them into our hands, and this shall be the sign to us. When both of them revealed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines said, behold, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden themselves. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will tell you something. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has given them into the hands of Israel. Then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet with his armor bearer behind him. Now, you just have to get this picture. This hillside they're climbing here is so steep that you don't walk up it. You climb it hand and foot. So you can just picture they sling their weapons, you know, the spear over the back, the one spear, the sword that Jonathan has, he sheaths, and they have to climb up hand over hand to get up the side of this hill to where the Philistines are. And then they get up there. It says, and they fell before Jonathan and his armor bearer, put some to death after him. So I picture Jonathan's knocking them down and the armor bearer's coming along and stabbing them. It's like, what an interesting form of teamwork. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half a furrow in an acre of land. And there was a trembling in the camp, in the field, and among all the people. Even the garrison and the raiders trembled, and the earth quaked so that it became a great trembling. So God sent an earthquake in addition to this at this very time. And you go, wow, God is able to deliver by many or by few. We get to skip down to verse 23. So the Lord delivered Israel that day, and the battle spread beyond Beth-Aven. So this is a battle that happened in 1 Samuel 14. The story of David and Goliath is in 1 Samuel 17. Guess what happened in 1 Samuel 13? And this is, you know, we're putting the piece of a puzzle. It was in 1 Samuel 13 that God said, I have found a man after my own heart. And he's talking about David. Now, why is that significant here? Because it talks about the timing of all this. This battle where Jonathan won this victory over the Philistines was not very far removed in time from the battle where David fought Goliath. And that should raise some questions as much as anything else. It raises some questions. They're not far removed in time. The Philistines, I think when we get to 1 Samuel 17, the Philistines don't want to repeat that. They're saying, whoa, wait a minute. Now, they for whatever reason, they choose to invade Israel, but they don't want to get into that that mismatched battle where they ought to destroy them and yet get their tails kicked. And so I think that's what's going on here. And they say, I have another strategy here. Let's not actually fight them. And so they bring out this guy by the name of Goliath, because their strategy seems to be to defeat the Israelites by intimidating them into submission. That's what seems to be their strategy. So enter Goliath, and as we bring in Goliath, there are some definite problems with Goliath when you start talking about it. And one of the problems is his size. I mean, once again, I'm not going to flip this up. I'm just going to leave it down like this. Now, I know I'm a short guy. I'm used to, in fact, I remember one picture we had with me and the elders. This is going back 20 years, and it was when cell phones and pictures like that were pretty new. And I'm looking on this, maybe it was a video camera, digital camera, I don't know. But I'm looking at this picture, and it's blown up, and I see elder, space, elder. I'm going, what's wrong? And it takes me a while to manipulate the camera down enough to where I see, oh, there I am. I'm used to being the short guy. I mean, I'm comfortable with that. Or maybe comfortable is not the right word because I whine. But, you know, but I'm sorry, that's another 4 feet. And people start saying, that's not possible. That can't be. And so they doubt the story of David and Goliath simply because of the size that Goliath is portrayed. And saying that's not something that could really happen. First of all, his size is not a problem for someone who believes the Bible, because it clearly teaches giants are real. We have these things called Nephilim. They show up in Genesis chapter 6. And I'm just going to do a real quick run-through of showing the biblical consistency of Goliath. Genesis chapter 6, verse 4. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. And so we have this word Nephilim introduced. The word Nephilim is only found twice in the Bible. And one of the things about definitions is you don't start with a definition and then make up a word to fit it. You find a word, like what Valerie Hamm is doing. They find words. They find how they're used, they come up from the way the word is used, and make the definition. When a word is only found twice, it's really hard to make a definition of that word. And so people have come up with different ideas of what the Nephilim are, anything from giants to heroes, heroic men. And it's something like, really those are the two options that people come up with. But I'm gonna argue for giants. I'm going to show you my argument. Numbers chapter 13, verse 33. Numbers 13, verse 33 says, there we also saw the Nephilim. This is the only other occurrence of the word Nephilim in the Bible. The sons of Anak are part of the Nephilim, and we became like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight. So we have two things there. We have Nephilim. It says the sons of Anak, or the Anakites, are Nephilim. They're some of the Nephilim. And then we have the comparison of size. We were like grasshoppers in our sight when we compared ourselves. And they have those two statements going on, the size and the Anakites. So we make another link. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 10 through 11. You have to do your homework to find all this, because it's not just laid out. The Bible isn't laid out like a textbook. I think that's a good thing. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verses 10 and 11. The Emim lived there, formerly a people as great, numerous, and tall as the Anakim. So we have, again, height as a significant factor in their description. Like the Anakim, they are also regarded as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Emim. So we have the next connection. We have Nephilim, Anakites, then we have Rephaim. And Rephaim is a word that many times in the New Testament, especially in the newer translations, is not translated Rephaim or Rephaites. It's translated giants. And Goliath was one of these. And we don't find that in 1 Samuel 17, but we do find it in 2 Samuel 21, 16 to 21. We have a list of these creatures. Then Ishbi-Benob, who was among the descendants of the giant, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels, which, by the way, is that spear. Almost exactly. 300 shekels of bronze in weight was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, helped him and struck the Philistine and killed him. Then the men of David swore to him, saying, "You shall not go out again with us to battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel." Now it came about after this that there was war with the Philistines at Gob. Then Sibbecai the Hushathite struck down Saph, who was among the descendants of the giant. Then there was war with the Philistines again at Gob, and Elhanan, the son of Jereoregim, don't say, "Oh, I heard how to pronounce these words from the pastor at Trinity Bible Fellowship." I'm just throwing out pronunciations. You can do what you want with them. They don't mean anything. So Jereoregim, the Bethlehemite who killed Goliath the Gittite, the shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam. Then there was war at Gath again, where there was a man of great stature who had six fingers on each hand and six toes on each foot, 20 in number, and also had been born to the giant. When he defied Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, David's brother, struck him down. These four were born to the giant in Gath and fell by the hand of David at the hand of his servants. So we have these giants of Gath. And so we have this clear connection between the Nephilim to Goliath. He is a giant. The Bible teaches this connection. And by the way, in Joshua chapter 11, when the Israelites conquered the promised land, they came in and they did battle in all these places. And I know for some people this is boring and tedious. For some people this is like candy. And you say, "Man, I want to hear more." Joshua chapter 11, verse 22. He mentions the city of Gath. "There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod, some remained." So it says there were only three cities left where any giants remained. One of them was Gath. And we have Goliath of Gath, or Goliath the Gittite. So when we start talking about Goliath, there's a lot of biblical evidence for a giant. That's not a problem. Okay, we go on to physical evidence. There's physical evidence that points to Goliath. Giant spearheads. This is a picture of spearheads in the Israeli Museum. I've been in this museum. Okay, it's been a long time ago. I actually don't remember seeing them. If I did, I didn't think about their significance. But these spearheads are found there. This is a picture taken by this man, whose name escapes me at the moment. He's got a website called Expedition Bible. It's on YouTube. If you'd like to follow Expedition Bible, you can find all sorts of things. And he's got one dedicated to that. That spearhead there roughly fits the dimensions of this spearhead here. You see, we couldn't get it. You can't tell a whole lot from a picture without something to give it scope. But the biggest spear that we saw there, this one right here, is this spear, and it's this size. And they talk about it. They say it's interesting things because it shows wear. It shows notches, and these aren't from decay. These are from abuse, battle things that the same thing seems to have happened. The shafts, strikingly, didn't survive. Funny, the wood didn't survive, but the metal did. And so this is something that physically exists there. It shows evidence of battle, and it's a real thing that's there really now. This is evidence of something. By the way, there was also evidence of plate armor there as well. But they have real evidence of something that size that was there. It's at a place called Kfar Monesh. They also, at the city of Gath, they have done excavations, and the structure shows a gate size. The walls, the stones, were of unusually large size, and the gate structure was of unusually large size. And so the size is really not a problem. There is evidence for these things. My question is more, why does he show up now? If that battle that Jonathan won was so short a time before this, why wasn't Goliath there then? Why wasn't he there? These are all, I like to bring up the problems. I feel like you have to address the problems if you're going to deal with these things. Where was he for Jonathan's battle? Why didn't they pull him out then? I mean, you got a tank. Why not use your tank? It just makes sense. And my theory is that he's a missionary who was brought to Gath, that he no longer, he and his people, which were very few in number at this point, in fact, I don't want to call them people because I don't classify them as human, but they were not there, and the Philistines said, hey, I have an idea. Let's bring back the giants. And they knew where to find him. They brought him down and made him their warrior. How does he know Hebrew? That's another problem, because he called out to the Hebrews, you know, send you a man to fight me. Let's get his quote. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel and said to them, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you the servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Again, the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. And he said this it had to be in the Hebrew language because he's telling it to the Hebrews and he wants them to understand him. It doesn't work well if he's speaking in another language. And so it's like, how did this guy know Hebrew? What? And then my best answer is, I don't know. I think one thing that's an evidence that he's an intelligent being and is able to speak in probably more than one language. Okay, so that's the problem with Goliath. But that introduces the characters. That is the basic elements of the story of David and Goliath and the Philistines and what they're doing here. And as we look at this, we find Israel was defeated without a battle. But before David ever gets there, the Israelites are defeated. So he called and he shouted out that challenge that I just read. Verse 11, when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. So they were dismayed, they were greatly afraid. He calls out, why do you come out and line up for battle? Do you hear the implication in this? Why are you guys going through the motions when you're not going to fight? Here I am. Come fight me. Send out a guy. Come on, send out a guy. Here I am. Send out a guy to fight me. Why are you guys even bothering to line up? You're making fools of yourselves. And the Israelites respond by standing there and not going out to fight him. There was not a man in the Israelite army who thought anyone would actually fight. Not only would they not fight this monster, they didn't think anybody would fight this monster. And if somebody did, he couldn't win. And so what is the point? And they had already accepted defeat. They were, the best they could do was sit there. And here's again my question. If the Philistines really wanted to invade, that this would be the time. But they don't. They're happy sitting back and winning this propaganda war, this philosophical battle. They exactly what they wanted to do was what is happening. This went on, verse 16, for 40 days. The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand. So 40 days of the Philistines and the Israelites lining up and him making his stand, and every day the Philistines or the Israelites are more and more defeated because the challenge won't go away. And they are not willing or able to do anything about the challenge. Okay, I'm going to stop being a historian here and start being a preacher. Christians are defeated without a battle all the time. We say, that battle looks too hard. I'm not going to enter it. Many Christians are living a life of going through motions. And so we go to church week after week and put on our Christian front so we look Christian, but we won't go into battle to prove it. We won't do anything to make it happen. The Israelite army is going through the motions. You never know how God can win the victory because you've never allowed him to. God will not generally go out and win victories without you doing something. Generally, he wants people to go. He wants people to speak. He wants people to act. The Israelite army went through the motions. And Christians are like that, and we cave. You know, we cave on theological issues. And when I say theological issues, I'm not talking about the things that theologians nitpick about. I'm not talking about some of those multisyllabic words that they say it's this, no, it's this, and we have to, and they, you know, how many angels dance on the pin, the head of a pin, or something like that. We're not doing that. I'm talking about major, basic theological issues. Is the Bible the Word of God? Is Jesus the only means of salvation? Is Jesus God? And Christians cave on those issues. Let me tell you something. If you hold to biblical truth, you will always be in a minority. Always. As a given, you will be in the minority. Not only will you be in the minority, the smart people, I hate to say that, no offense, the smart people are against you. Not meaning that we aren't smart or that they have more intelligence than us, but tend to have a lot more degrees on the other side than on our side. Doesn't mean you can't find degrees and smart people on our side, but when people say, well, all the scholarship agrees, first of all, they're wrong. All the scholarship doesn't agree, but they feel like they've got the case won, and by implication, they're saying, anybody who disagrees with us is stupid. Why would you Christians be so stupid? Before I got saved, I had a conviction about Christians. I thought Christians were either so dumb that they didn't understand the truth that was laid out before them simply. Like, for instance, I would have held this story up as a story Christians are so dumb as to believe. And here I am saying, man, I believe it. So I am now dumb. Or they were so dishonest that they pretended that they believed what they did not believe. And there was nothing but a facade. That's what I thought about Christians at the time. And I understand when you get intimidated by them and so you back off. And I'm saying, you're doing what the army did. Issues like creation, salvation only through Christ, inspiration of Scripture, David and Goliath, Jonah and the belly of a fish, Noah and the flood. And many Christians live a life of just going through Christian motions. That's the theological issues. Moral issues. Christians cave on moral issues all the time. I know the Bible says that behavior is wrong, but that's just how people are today. We have to accept it because we have to get along in today's world. I could do that, but it would cost me money. Or it might cost me my job, or it might prevent me from getting a promotion. And so they hang on to the name of Christian, just the name of Christian, but prevent themselves from actually paying a price or taking a risk to do it. A funny thing happened when David came along. They didn't know what to do with him. David comes up, right? David, at this point, he had been, you remember he was going back and forth from Saul to watching his father's flock. Well, this is one of those watching his father's flock thing. I think it's intriguing that Saul didn't want David along. And I think Saul did not want David along. I don't think he was merely, oh man, David's off the schedule, I guess I'll leave him alone. I think he wanted David not there because he was afraid of what David would do. Saul was intimidated by David. Saul the warrior, David the shepherd boy. I'm pretty sure Saul was intimidated by it. We know that he turns on David after this. And if we look at chapter 17, verse 28. Now, I'll go back a little bit. Verse 26. Then David spoke to the men who were standing by him, saying, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God?" David's just there. He doesn't know this has been going on for 40 days. It doesn't say he knew. The people answered him in accord with this word, saying, "Thus and thus it will be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his older brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David. And he said, "Why have you come down, and with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle." And Eliab does not understand his own little brother. which makes a lot of sense because who understands his own little brothers get no respect. Those of you who are little brothers, I apologize to you. I'm an older brother. Little brothers, you will never get the respect. I shouldn't say never. But it's just a birth order thing. I don't know. And Eliab did not understand his own little brother was sincere. David's coming along. He's saying, who's this Philistine? Yeah, he's big. Easier to hit. You know, it's like, come on. It's like, what's the problem here? And Eliab says, oh, you little twerp. You just came to see a battle. You wanted to be entertained. Well, yeah, and that's not at all what David wants. But Eliab cannot ascribe to David the faithfulness that David actually has because Eliab doesn't have it. And because he doesn't have it, he can't see it and believe it's real. And defeated Christians don't realize you can live a life of not defeat because they have yielded and compromised. We see someone with the faith we ought to have, and we just assume there's something wrong with their motives, that it's not real, it's not true, or that they're selling something. We need to stop that. We need to learn to respect it, admire it, and aspire to it. What we don't do is believe in the actual true faithfulness, because if it was real, then we should be showing that kind of faith too. They don't understand. David doesn't understand them. I don't think David understood why someone hadn't already gone down and done this. He's, what's going to be done for the guy who does this? Man, he ought to get a reward. This guy's big. This is scary. He ought to get a reward for doing that. What? No one's doing it? I'll do it. He doesn't understand the problem. Verses 32 through 37. David said to Saul, let no one's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. Then Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came along, took a lamb from the flock, I went after him, attacked him and rescued him from its mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go and may the Lord be with you. For David, he said, I've trusted God before. He's never let me down. And he's talking to people who say, wow, I guess I haven't trusted God before. God says, David says, I have trusted God with my life before. And he has taken me through that. What he did then, he'll do now. He says, the way God has always been in the past, he's still being God. And these people don't know what David's talking about because they haven't done what David's done. But he has proven God, and he sees the challenge, and he's looking around to see what will happen, and he doesn't. So he just says, I'll do it. And somehow, in his statement of faith, he convinced Saul to let him try. First, Saul wants to protect him. Verse 33. Then Saul said to David, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight him. You're but a youth while he's been a warrior from his youth. Saul's saying, David, I don't want you to go out there. You're just going to get yourself killed. You're just a kid. I know you. You want to do it. You can't do it. Just stay back, David. And Saul's not doing that. He's not spurning David or scorning him. Saul loved David. He said that earlier. He's going to be afraid of him as soon as David kills Goliath. Right now he's trying to protect him. And then he sees David's faith, says, go and may the Lord be with you. And he allows him to go. And David goes out there and he makes it clear. You know, we see the sling, and it's funny. You start reading what people say about these things. One guy said the message of David and Goliath was a message about the power of a sling as a weapon. I'm going, you buddy, you are an idiot. It's like, yeah, it's a good weapon. You want to watch videos on how to use a sling? They're pretty cool. These people destroy things with slings. They send them across a distance. They hit with power and accuracy, and you go, wow, that's a good weapon. That's not what the story of David and Goliath is about. I'm sorry. Verses 38 through 40, they try to arm David for battle. Then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head, and he clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, for he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David, so picture, you have armor. Saul was a big guy. It said he was head and shoulders above all the other Israelites, right? David is a normally sized guy. So by contrast, we'll take one of our bigger guys. I remember once I had we did this thing in the youth group a gazillion years ago. I bought this enormous-sized long underwear. And the kids put them on, and the first part of the game was stuffing them with balloons. And the contest was to see who could stuff the most balloons into the other's underwear, right? And it was fun. And they're shoving these underwear, and these kids are just getting these, you know, look like the Michelin balloon man. And then I said, okay, who has the most? Oh, you didn't count? And that's when it gets fun, because I pull out two needles. And you count as you pop them. And it's you see, I am still mean. That sounds so much fun. And it was, but afterwards, I go, what do I do with this underwear? It's too big. Nobody can wear this. So I went to Fred Bell. If you don't know Fred, he's 6'5". And I said, hey, Fred, this is too big for, I know this is big, but maybe you can use it. He put it on and it fit perfect. I'm going, whoa, that's like gargantuan. He goes, yeah, Steve. Yes, Fred. Picture David walking around in Saul's clothes, his armor. It's like clunk, clunk, I can't do this. He's a little boy in daddy's clothes. He can't wear it. David says, I can't wear this stuff. David girded his sword over, David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch. And his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, we can talk about David's confidence in his weapon. We can talk about the reason for 5 stones, and I'll mention that at least briefly, but you know what David's doing? Is David is saying that what God has already equipped me with is what I need for the battle he is calling me to. If God is calling you to a battle, he's already equipped you for that battle. Amen. Yeah. Say it louder. That's another big guy thing. Mike Kroll once pounded on this thing and it bounced. And I went, whoa. I went up, I tried it. Yeah, God. If God has called you to a battle, he has equipped you for that battle. But David, he didn't say, God has equipped me for this battle, I can do it. He said, the Lord will win this battle. David was equipped for the battle, but he wasn't say, because I'm equipped, I can win the battle. He said, the Lord will win this battle. And so David, he did not need to be an expert at Goliath's tools to fight Goliath or to defeat Goliath. He needed to be an expert, not even an expert, well, he was an expert, I believe. But he only had to use the weapons that God had already given him. And David chooses 5 smooth stones. And maybe that was, we don't know. The Bible does not tell us why David chose 5 smooth stones. We know he only used one of them. And so maybe he's a reloader. And he says, I might miss when I use the first one, so I want to be ready. But you want to know what argues about this? Verse 48, then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand into the bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. David was running toward the Philistine, you know, reaches in, grabs a bag as he's doing it, and I got to be careful I don't go off the end. and he slung it. He was closing the gap. How much time did he have if he missed to reload? See, David was not afraid of his ability to hit the giant, but that's my theory. So perhaps he was ready to reload, but I already read the names of 4 more giants. Now, an interesting thing about those 4 more giants is that's at the end of 2 Samuel. This is in the middle of 1 Samuel. We don't know when those battles with those 4 giants happened, but they happened over essentially a generation. David was 30 when he's not 30 when he fights this battle. He was 30 when he became king, and he reigned for 40 years. Over the course of that time, these other giants fell in battle. I'm of the theory these are Goliath's sons. I'm also of the theory that they ended the line of giants. We never read about giants again after this. And the fact that one of the giants had 6 fingers and 6 toes on each hand and each foot seems to indicate birth defects, and I think they were a dying race. And Goliath is the end of them. But again, that's just theories coming out. But if there were 5 giants out there, and those 5 giants, the other 4 giants were big enough to be a threat and old enough to be a threat, you want to know what happened in that battle after David killed Goliath? David did not flee from the giants. The giants, if they were there, they fled from him. Because David proved God wins. Because he fought the battle. David, verses 45 to 47. Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Philistines, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I will strike you down and remove your head from you, and I will give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands." And he leaves no doubt whatsoever. This is God's battle, and he is doing there. He could have said, "You do not appreciate how deadly this sling is." Because it is. David was good with the sling. He'd used it before, right? He could have said that. He could have boasted about his skill. He could have boasted about his ability. He left no doubt this was a battle in God's hands. And shocking, surprise, David won. It's a story of courage and faith. But the story of And all the things we do for the kids. By the way, back there, I helped Joan load up the song. One of the songs he was loading up was "David Saw Goliath, Big Old Ugly Giant." Anybody know that song? David was not frightened. He did not run away. So it's a kid's classic. Kids love those songs. They love the stories. It never goes out of style with the kids, but we don't bring it to the adults. We need to bring this story to the adults. It is not a story you should ever outgrow. It's not a story you should dismiss in any way. David is an example of the response we should all have when we face challenges to our faith. Keep your confidence in God and win the battles of faith. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you for this story. Father, I thank you for how familiar it is and how much truth and power is in this story. Father, let us walk in faith with you. We pray in Jesus' name.